Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and this is another segment of Our Community, where I get to chat with some of the most interesting people in our area. You know, I love autumn, especially here in Brookings. September and October are often two of our most beautiful months here on the coast. Usually the sun is shining, and you can feel that chill at night that means the rainy season and cold weather is on its way. But fall means something else to people here. It means mushrooms and the Mushroom Festival. Here to tell us all about it is my guest today, Kathleen Dixon, who began this hugely successful festival 3 years ago now. Welcome to the show, Kathleen.
Thanks, Candace. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Just so that our listeners know, Kathleen and I are great friends, and we seldom actually get a chance, because we're both so busy, to sit down and chat. So we're both looking forward to this opportunity to just sit and chat for a while.
Exactly. We're going to pretend like we got a cup of coffee in front of us,
yes,
and we're hanging out in the living room, and we're just catching up.
Yes, exactly. I love that. So, Kathleen, we're definitely going to talk about the shrooms and the festival and all that stuff, but let's start a little bit with you. Like, you know, where do you come from and how did you end up in Brookings?
Well, we have an interesting story. 17 years ago, September 11th, was the day we landed here. So that was 2002. We came here, we meaning Rich and I, my husband, we came here from Colorado. When we were in Colorado, we had different lives completely. He was a drywaller. I worked in offices. I was a legal secretary, believe it or not.
Wow.
We met. We were. We both needed a change of pace, and he had lived on the West Coast, and I never had. And so he said, let's just go west as far as we can go, and then we'll find a place to live. And I'm like, cool. So we packed everything that we could. We sold a lot of stuff. Packed a bunch of stuff in my car, which we stored at his mom's house, and we started to the coast.
Wow.
Took us 6 weeks to get here because we went down to New Mexico and saw the Grand Canyon, and we went across the extraterrestrial highway in Nevada, spooky place, and landed in California. We saw the Sierras. We went to Yosemite, and this was all basically off-season. It was the end of August, early September. And then across to San Francisco, I finally got to see Chinatown. Three trips I'd taken through San Francisco, and I'd never seen Chinatown.
Really?
So I made it a point.
Okay.
We walked up the road and down the road, and then we drove off.
Good
on
for
the
you.
101. Anyway, and we got to Crescent City and stopped at the parks office. And we're looking for a place to camp. And he mentioned Clifford Camp from Memorial Park, which is 2 miles into California from Oregon. That's where we landed. We got to know the camp hosts. It was off season, so they let us stay there longer than normal. Turns out they were leaving as camp hosts, so we took the job of camp host that next summer.
Amazing.
3 years we were there. In the meantime, we'd met a mushroom picker. His name was Red, red hair.
Of course.
He introduced us to the mushroom camps. The Forest Service, back in the day, used to provide campgrounds for mushroom pickers. And you would buy your permit for 6 months, your commercial permit, and then that would give you permission to live in the camp. They would provide porta potties and trash collection. And otherwise, you were on your own.
You're kidding.
It was fabulous. And we landed here like 2 years before they shut those things down. So it was serendipitous that we landed here when we did. I really believe that. I had no idea
there were even things like that.
Yeah.
How amazing.
You know, it was as though, I mean, it was a way for us to get our feet on under us. And so we lived with these mushroom pickers. This was the year of the biscuit fire. This was 2002.
Okay.
So all of the pickers had been moved out of the forest and they'd closed the road, the North Bank. And these guys were all down on Social Security bar waiting for the Forest Service to open the road. So that's where we met them.
Wow.
And we followed them up to the camp. And we stayed in a camp that first winter. I had my first Thanksgiving and Christmas in the camp. It was a blast.
Now, how far up is the camp?
So Loeb is like 8 miles up, and then you go a couple miles further, you cross that bridge, that's called Second Bridge, and as soon as you cross that, that's Forest Service territory. You can see the sign, you've been up there, and about a mile or maybe it's two past that is where Snake Tooth branches off, that's 1107. You go up Snake Tooth, about a mile, or so, and there was a right-hand turn, and that was A Camp. You would go back in. It was basically almost the base of Mount Emily, but not off South Bank, off North Bank.
Wow.
Because you could hike down to Emily Creek Drainage and up on Mount Emily from A Camp.
Amazing.
Which my husband did with a couple of guys. They caught a salmon in Emily Creek, though.
Oh, wow.
I don't remember they brought it back to camp. I think they caught it and let it go with their bare hands. Not with fishing poles.
Nice.
With their bare hands.
Yeah, nice.
We had a ball up there.
Well, you know, that's probably the way it used to be done, you know. Bare hands if you've got your hands.
Exactly. Well, there were three of them, and they were feeling quite happy at the time. But anyway.
So how many camps?
There were three.
Okay.
A, B, and C. Okay. And B and C were actually up much further. Instead of going up Snake Tooth, you would follow North Bank all the way through Wilderness Retreat, mm-hmm. across to what they call Steel Bridge, mm-hmm. and then that branches, and the old Lavender Farm, B&B, was on the left branch. The Chetco Bar Fire, that was one of the places they managed to save, was mm-hmm. the old B&B.
Right.
And then you would go past it and up about, I can't remember how many miles, maybe two, and then B and C were right across from each other.
Hmm.
And we lived in C Camp, the second winter we mm-hmm. were here. We split our time between Sea Camp and the campground mm-hmm. where we were then camp
right,
hosts.
Right.
And we just learned how to pick mushrooms from commercial pickers. So it was an interesting way to learn. And all my forte is edible mushrooms. I don't necessarily, people think I know everything there is to know about mushrooms, and I don't. I know the edibles 100%. I know what can and can't be eaten within our area. But I also really focus on the ones that are commercially bought and sold.
Mm-hmm.
So although I know, for instance, what a bluet looks like and how to identify a bluet, it's one of the edibles, it's not one that's commercially bought and sold. And so I just don't pick it. So mm-hmm. I don't have patches for it. I mm-hmm. don't know where you find it. You know, chanterelles? Yeah, I can mm-hmm. do chanterelles. Mm-hmm. So
you still know where chanterelles are?
Yes, except that unfortunately the Chetco Bar Fire burned quite a bit of the area that we used to hunt.
Did it?
Yeah, and the fire was so hot mm-hmm. in places that it burned everything, including the mycelium that's under the ground. They did a study after the Chetco Bar Fire. I don't remember the percentages. Somebody that is a forester could probably tell you, but of the burned area, about maybe a fourth of it burned so hot it burned into the soil, and that's where it pretty much kills all life. So those places, it's going to be decades before they come back. They'll come back
mm-hmm.
because mushrooms are an opportunistic critter. I think I shouldn't say mushrooms either. I should say mycelium, because that's the living entity, is the mycelium. The mushrooms are more like the apples on a tree would be. That's
okay.
just the part of the critter. Because
mm-hmm.
it's not a plant.
Right.
It's not an animal either.
Interesting.
It's a fungi.
Yes.
But that's the part that the fungi puts out to procreate, mm-hmm. to replicate, mm-hmm. to you know, take on more
right.
territory.
So the mycelium is this kind of network that is mm-hmm. under the ground.
Yeah.
And it's the way the fungi spreads.
It's kind of, yeah, in one way the mm-hmm. fungi spreads with its mycelium mm-hmm. threads, mm-hmm. but really the mycelium connects everything to everything else. There's a new book out and a new film out. The book is called Fantastic Fungi, and I just bought it from Amazon. I rarely buy books from Amazon, but I had to have this one. Paul Stamets is one of the editors. Paul is the premier mycologist in the country. David Arora, I think, is pretty close. But anyway, Paul Stamets is one of the editors, and they've been doing a number of studies. And one of the theories right now is that the mycelium that's underneath our feet is everywhere underneath our feet, and it's connecting everything to everything.
Literally and everything?
Literally, yeah. Like, you know, all
wow.
the trees and all the bushes and all the plants, somehow or another, this mycelium is connecting it all. And there are also even theories that say that back during the Big Bang, fungi was one of the first living things to be in on our Earth, that it came from outer space, in other words, that fungi somehow, the
Amazing.
Spore, I don't know, came from outer space, and that was what first populated our Earth. So, you know, whether
yeah.
or not that's true, I do believe that fungi is very, very ancient and very smart and very well adapted and it takes an awful lot to get rid of it. Anyone who's seen dry rot knows that's a fungi.
Really?
That's breaking down that wood. Yeah.
Wow.
Fungi has a lot of purposes, and one of the purposes that we see that's very obvious is the rotting capabilities. Mm-hmm. In other words, mm-hmm. certain kinds of myceliums, their job is to break down the lignin in wood so that it breaks down into dirt, into compost. Everything goes back to dirt. If we didn't have fungi breaking this stuff down, can you imagine how much stuff would be on this planet?
You'd have a bunch of wood.
Among other things. Yeah, because they say what's really cool, bioremediation is another, or mycoremediation, my bad. Mycoremediation is another new concept that Paul Stamets was at the forefront of. And it's where you take particular kinds of mycelium and you use it to clean toxins from water, from soil. He's done a number of studies that have shown, one was in the forest, and I don't remember the details, my bad. I read all this stuff,
of
and then
course.
I remember bits.
It's hard to remember
yeah.
the details.
So don't quote me on any of this stuff, folks. But he did some studies where he ran some dirty water, oil, I think it was, mm-hmm. through this mat of mycelium, mm-hmm. and at the other end tested the water, and it came out clean.
You're kidding.
And so he's huge. When Mycelium Running is his other good book that if you want to buy a couple of fascinating books on what
and
fungi does, Paul Stamets, okay. Stamets.
Excellent.
He's going to come to our festival one of these days.
No, really?
One of these days.
Okay. We'll just keep pressuring.
Give me 5 years. I'm working on it.
But that's an amazing amount of information.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just incredible.
And you know, that's people, when people talk to me about mushrooms, they're really wanting to know, where do I find chanterelles? Or
yeah.
can I eat this mushroom that I found in my backyard? Or will this mushroom hurt my dog if
right.
he nibbles it?
Right.
But there's so much more about mycelium than just the mushrooms that they produce.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff, I mean, some people say, and that's part of the basis of Fantastic Fungi, that book I started talking about, and the movie that goes with it. I'm not going to say the title because I cannot remember it for sure, but there's a movie out, and the premise is that mushrooms may be, mycelium may be the one thing that can save our planet because of all of its different jobs, all of its different adaptations, all of its different purposes. It's as though this is the thread that ties it all together. That
and isn't that
it's
amazing?
Just, it's fascinating.
It is. It's amazing that the planet actually has something that will allow it to recover.
Well, yes, and maybe not. I mean,
yeah.
it depends on you know how intelligent you believe life is,
mm-hmm.
not just people,
right.
but all of life in general.
Right.
And if you can, if you can think for a second that perhaps this mycelium does have a level of intelligence that allows it to connect,
mm-hmm.
to be the web that connects mm-hmm. everything, mm-hmm. it's a lot like the internet.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's some pictures in the book about the similarities. It's a connector. Fungi is a connector, and it could be the basic connector, the one thing that connects all life and keeps it going. So there could be hope yet.
So I had no idea you were going to say any of that stuff. I'm amazed.
I've been devouring this book since I bought it.
Well,
and that's why it's all in my head.
Yeah,
right,
I'm going to have to get that book because that just sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
So, in addition to having your finger in the pie called mushrooms,
mm-hmm.
you've also done a lot since you got here.
Yeah, we landed in the world of mushrooms first, but the following summer, 2003, we met a guy who sold peaches from the Rogue Valley, and that's what landed us into the local food world. We started out with those peaches from Medford.
Which were insanely good.
They were. Yes, they were quite good. We decided to try a little bit of farming ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly to legitimize what we were trying to share with people, that,
mm-hmm.
that local food is important, that organic food is important, and that, yes, we're for real. We really do want to give you the best food possible, so we will grow some ourselves just
mm-hmm.
to show you that, yeah, we mean what we say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started a small farm, And we started a small CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Program. That's how Candace and I know each other.
It was so fun.
It was. And we named ourselves Otterbees.
Mm-hmm. So, I love that name.
Well, and that is courtesy. Now, the same gentleman that draws the logo for the Mushroom Festival, mm-hmm. Richard Wickstrom, he's the guy who drew the logo for Otterbees.
No kidding.
He was a customer as well.
It's great.
And it's a fabulous logo.
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah.
And Otterbees became the name Farm and Fungi to start with. We mm-hmm. are now Otterbees Market because we, number one, no longer farm. We no longer sell at markets, farmers markets. We are an online enterprise now mm-hmm. only. So to buy from us, you have to get to our website and you order through our website. But we now carry all the local food we can find. Local meaning within 200 miles of here, 150. Mm-hmm. Most
a lot of
it's coastal.
Is organic.
Almost all at this mm-hmm. point, yeah. There's still mm-hmm. a few things that aren't. They're IPM grown, integrated pest management.
And what
Misty
is
and
that?
Misty and I talked about that.
Okay.
Integrated pest management is basically a method by which the farmer can maintain a financial level that he needs to be at and yet still be as organic as possible. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you have a crop, say it's peaches, and say that you're willing to lose about 10% of that crop and still be financially viable. And so as the season progresses, you're using organic methods. You've cleaned up your orchard in the winter so there's no fruit on the ground to rot and attract pests. You've done all your prunings. You've burned them all. You're keeping everything at bay as best you can. And then along comes one of the fruit fly. We'll use that as a good example. The Drosophila fruit fly, which is the scourge of the area these days. And it comes along and it starts to infect your peaches. And you notice you're losing more than 10% of your peaches, or you're risking that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point at which you can spray.
Mm-hmm.
If you use a pesticide, as an IPM grower, you choose the least toxic pesticide you can find. And there are a lot of product on the market that's designed for IPM growers. They create them purposely to be as least toxic as possible. And you use that. If you have to spray more than once, you rotate with other types so that you don't let the bugs build up a resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that combined allows you to grow a profitable product mm-hmm. and still be kind to your environment. Mm-hmm. That's what IPM is.
That's great. That's excellent.
And the hardest things to grow without chemicals are stone fruits.
Mm-hmm.
Corn is difficult as well. If you're willing to accept a corn earworm in the tip of your corn, then organic's the way to go. But I hate to say it, a lot of consumers don't like to peel back their corn and find a corn earworm.
Right.
And so because of that, a lot of farmers spray. That's where the BT resistant or the BT infused corn came from, the GMO corns.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Monsanto, it might not have been Monsanto, my bad. One of the chemical companies developed a product that you sprayed on your corn. That was in the seed itself,
mm-hmm,
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the seed had this BT infused into it. BT is a naturally occurring substance, but this was a man-made substance.
Mm-hmm.
And the corn grew up, and it was automatically resistant to the corn earworm.
Mm-hmm.
And that would avoid your infesting. But it's a GMO corn.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, us as consumers, we play a big part in what is and isn't done to our food.
Oh, I agree. And I think that, you know, we've lost sight of what it takes to actually produce food.
Yeah.
Most of us.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you live in a city.
Yeah.
I mean, you think, you know, you go to the grocery store and there's the food and there's no factoring in of natural, mm-hmm. the world and how it affects the growing of that food and how it affects the harvesting of mm-hmm. that food or the storing of the food. I mean, it's like we're completely not tuned in mm-hmm. to the process.
Yeah.
And it's a problem as far as I'm concerned.
It can be, which is why Otterbees focuses on local food only.
Mm-hmm.
We figure at least that way our customers have the option anytime they choose of going to visit any one of the local food producers that we work with.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pages on the website shows you all the different producers that we work with and includes their contact info, their website if they have one, their Facebook page, and we encourage customers to go visit. So Say you want to know how Valley Flora, for instance, grows their organic corn. Mm-hmm. You can go on up to Langlois. Mm-hmm. It's 67 miles away. Mm-hmm. Run up there on a Wednesday or a Saturday when their farm stand is open and chat with Zoe or Abby or Amelia or any of them. Mm-hmm. And they will walk you through it. They'll probably take you to the corn and show you. Aww. You know, you can see it from the road. Yeah. And that's the beauty of it. So our customers know that what they're getting, they can actually go and see for themselves that it's really what we say it is.
And how it's grown and what some of the issues are and, you know, the challenges.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who has never been a farmer or never spent time has no clue what the challenges are.
And that was one of the reasons we decided in the beginning to have a small farm for a while. Mm-hmm. We had to see for ourselves what it took. Mm-hmm. And frankly, guys, we were not good farmers. We're great at, I can sell ice cubes to Eskimos, but I can't grow them very well.
Growing ice cubes are difficult.
But we learned, you know, we know all of these fabulous growers and these fantastic food producers. We know them and they do their job well.
Yep.
And I don't need to be the one growing it. I just need to be the one promoting it for everybody else.
You're kind of the mycelium. You connect everybody.
Yeah, I try.
Kathleen the mycelium. Now, there's also something about, I think it's called the Wild Rivers Coast Food Trail.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
So the Wild Rivers Coast Food Trail came from an effort that Travel Oregon was making back in, the history of it is back in 2014, Travel Oregon came to the area with their Rural Tourism Studio. They do these all over the state, and it's designed to bring communities together and work on finding your strengths from a tourism standpoint, and then building on those, capitalizing on those. Travel Oregon supports the effort with a grant in the initial stages, and our community went through a rural tourism studio in 2014. From that studio came the action team known as Eat Fresh and Local.
Mm.
Kathy Bowden was the original leader, and she's the one that it took off under her tutelage. I came on as a volunteer to start with, helped her in the first few years build a farm trail, Wild Rivers Coast Farm Trail, which was mostly poured over to Bandon and included the main farms up there, blueberries, cranberries, veggies, a couple of the markets, and a store or two. In 2018, Oregon Coast Visitors Association, also known as OCVA, one of our regional destination marketing organizations, or RDMOs, they brought on a young woman named Liz Gronert. She was a RARE. RARE stands for Rural. I knew I was going to get this wrong.
Agriculture?
No, Rural something Resources Economy.
Okay, good.
The point is, she was like a Peace Corps.
Okay.
She came on, she worked for OCVA, and she assisted our team with this food trail. So the first thing we did was we decided it needed to build capacity, both the variety of businesses on the trail and geographically. We took that trail from 9 members to 39 members in 2018. We expanded it to include all the way down to Brookings and all the way up to Reedsport, 135 miles.
Wow.
And we added seafood places, stores and restaurants, artisan markets, of course, breweries, and farms. So we now have 6 categories, and to be on the trail, you have to have, your focus has to be on local. Either you're growing it yourself, you're sourcing it, sourcing local in the case of restaurants, as a brewery, you're making your own brew, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
We're realistic. We're on the coast, and we know that you cannot source 100% of your ingredients from within your local 200-mile radius area. So we allow restaurants, for instance, to average out about a percentage over the course of a whole year. So say in the summertime when everything's on, you're probably serving 75% of your stuff as local. But in the dead of winter, with the exception of maybe seafood and greens, it's a little hard to get local, and you might be down to 30%.
Right.
But overall, it averages. Mm-hmm. And then we allow different categories to maintain different percentages depending on who they are. So a brewery, for instance, we want for the majority of their beers to be their own, but of course we also encourage them to serve each other's. And so we don't require that 100% of the brews they serve are from within the local area, but the majority. And then we cross-pollinate. We promote each other. We have a website. We have a Facebook page. We have Instagram. And the idea is to drive. When tourists come to our area, they get a sense of the taste of place. That was a phrase that Kathy came up with.
I like that.
Taste of place that helps them to see that they're in... They're in the south coast of Oregon. They're not in Maine. They're not in inland Oregon. They're not down in California in wine country. They're here along the coast. Mm-hmm. And so what they're tasting is coming from the coast, and it gives them that sense that they've been someplace special, I guess.
And there is a different taste.
Sure.
I mean, things taste different depending on where they were raised.
For instance, cranberries. So it's cranberry season now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you saw, there was an article on TV somewhere recently about the cranberry industry. Oregon Coast cranberries, and that is a section from Port Orford up to about Coos Bay in that area. Mm-hmm. Those cranberries are sweeter than any of the cranberries grown anywhere, and that's because here on the coast, we don't freeze. And so they don't have to harvest their cranberries ahead of the frost like they do in Michigan. Where else do they grow cranberries? There's another big state that does a lot of cranberries.
Interesting.
We can wait to harvest until those berries are as ripe as they can possibly be.
Which makes them sweeter.
Yes, exactly. And so that's one thing. The soil is also different. Cranberries are one of the few things that can grow in the area that they're growing in along the coast. And that's because that's a very sandy, very poor soil. Cranberries love it. Acidic, sandy, that's their thing. And so that's what they like.
God, that's just, it's fascinating that it actually, you know, produces the most delicious cranberries. I mean, that's just fascinating.
The other thing that you learn, if you go to a cranberry bog, and we've got two of them on the food trail, Peter's Cranberries and Bowman Bogs, is that they don't grow in water. A lot of people think they grow in bogs, like rice. Mm-hmm. No, they don't grow in bogs. The water is designed to help the harvest, to make the harvest easier.
Oh.
They flood the bog when the time is right. They beat the berries off the bush with bog beaters, each of which has basically been built by the farmer. There is no John Deere bog beater out there. All of these bog beaters are specific to the owners.
Right.
And they also terrace the bogs. And so your first bog is up here. And then as that water filters through, you just transfer it to the next bog. And to the next bog. So you're using the same water.
Right.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It is.
Now, see, I thought they grew in water.
A lot of people do.
Yeah. Wow.
And I thought so, too, till I got to be a part of the farm, of the food trail, and discovered that, no, that's not the case.
That is just fascinating.
There is also a method by which they dry harvest, and those, in fact, they don't flood those bogs. They pick them. They have special rakes that they use that clog with the vines constantly.
Right.
So they're very labor intensive.
Right.
But they rake them up. And then those are the fresh cranberries that go to stores as fresh. And that's the kind I carry. Otterbeek's Market sells Cape Blanco cranberries fresh, usually November, December. And those have been dry harvested because they keep longer. Because water, like with anything else, when something gets wet, it starts to rot faster.
Right.
That's
just the way it is. Yeah, yeah. Just want to let people know that you're listening to KCIWLP, and this is Our Community, and I'm talking with Kathleen Dixon. So I think that that's just remarkable. I mean, it's just amazing that we have that many resources in the area for local food, and that you can actually go and look at it and talk to the people involved. And it's a remarkable thing. And it just goes to show you that if people actually are focused on doing things that better the community, that it actually happens.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You know, it's funny because Travel Oregon's goal in setting up these food trails, because there are others now. Ours was kind of the pilot.
Great.
And now there's probably five or six out there.
Excellent.
All with the same basic logo and different names.
Mm-hmm.
But Travel Oregon's goal is to support and promote tourism. But what also happens with our food trail, at least, and I imagine it happens with others, is we get locals discovering their own taste of place.
Yeah.
We've got people from Coos Bay, for instance, that come down to Brookings or to Gold Beach because they've seen these businesses on the food trail. It helps that we unveiled our passport program this last summer.
What is that?
The passport program is a way to further market the food trail. It's like you get a passport to go visit. You get a little passport booklet, and the idea is you go and visit the different places on the food trail, and you have each of them stamp their section. And once you get a number of stamps, then you go and you turn it in for prizes.
Ooh.
A lot of breweries use passport programs. Ireland's got a fabulous passport. Nebraska, the state of Nebraska, has a passport program for the entire state.
You're kidding.
It's so cool. And every year they promote different businesses and they promote a number of different categories of businesses. Mm-hmm. And they have almost a contest where people see who can be the first to fill up the entire booklet. And they get their name on the honor roll kind of thing and stuff. We're trying to figure out how to award our people that get all 43 businesses stamped.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
But the idea behind the passport program was to encourage more travel in mm-hmm. amongst the food mm-hmm. trail. And what we're finding is people are visiting different sections of the region. It's 135 miles long. Mm-hmm. There's 43 businesses on it this year. Mm-hmm. So it takes you some time and some mm-hmm. doing. But they've learned. Somebody wrote a comment in the survey that we take before we give them their prize. They wrote that normally they would, they were from Bandon, and they would normally just go on through Brookings on their way to Arcata or wherever. Mm-hmm. And because of the passport program, they stopped.
Oh, that's
excellent. And they checked out some of these businesses, and they've decided to come back.
Good.
That's what it's designed to do.
Exactly.
Is get people out of their comfort zones,
right.
out of their box, get them on the road, get them to exploring, even if it's just 40 miles away or 100 miles away.
And and to actually find these mm-hmm. treasures that maybe a local knows about, but if you're 30 or 40 miles away, you don't have any clue.
It's funny because our towns are all about 25 miles from each other. I understand that was based on the old wagon train type of, or missions.
How far you could ride a horse
in
a day.
Exactly, 25 miles.
Yeah.
And so we're not that far from each other, but in terms of mindset and even culture sometimes, it's amazing how few people have maybe gone up to Port Orford lately.
Yes.
When in fact, there's some fabulous things to see and do up in Port Orford. And it's only an hour and 5 minutes from my house. I know, because I go there every week.
Right. But I know how you get. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I live on the north side of the Chetco Bridge.
Oh, Lord, that bridge.
And there are days when I do not want to have to cross the bridge. I just don't.
When we first moved here, we lived in Harbor. All the way down on the border, you could throw a rock and hit California where we lived. And that's where we farmed as well. And it was like I hardly ever came into Brookings. It was like, except for the library.
Yeah.
And my bank. My bank was up there too.
Right.
But otherwise, I didn't want to go to Brookings. That's so far away. And
I know.
then we moved to the north end of town. And now we're 6 miles north of town. And I'm like, Harbor? I don't want to go to Harbor. And
it's
I don't really mean that.
No,
but
the
mindset's
so
there.
Silly.
Sure.
It's just silly.
Sure,
but you know, maybe it's what happens as you get older too, is that, you know, you're just not as inclined on a daily basis to want to, you know, do those.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, you know, come from big cities where in order to get to work, at mm-hmm. one point we had to drive an hour one way every day. And, you know, we just don't want to have to do that anymore.
Sure. And I understand that. I have been here 17 years and I came from a small town. I've lived most of my lives in small towns. And so I didn't live that mm-hmm. that type of life,
right.
with the exception of when we lived in Indianapolis, and I used to work downtown Indy, and we lived south or north. But that wasn't near the commute that LA would be, or Denver, or, you know. But you get to where you're comfortable in this very small mm-hmm. place, mm-hmm. and you just start to think, oh, Gold Beach, oh, that's way too far. I don't want to go to Gold Beach. And it's only 25 miles.
I know. Of course, if the road.
Oh, speaking of the road, it's moving again. The
Husqvarna. No.
It's moving again. Not very much, only about an inch, but there's a little bump. And then I heard on the news last night, it's definitely well, starting its move.
It's going to continue to move. Sure. I mean, you know, isn't there a stream underneath it?
That whole mountain's moving.
Right? Exactly.
That's what it's designed to do. It's all trying to float into the
sea. And it's interesting that as a species, we think that we should be able to control everything. And it's like, really? Yeah. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. We are quite arrogant in that way, aren't we? And I get it. I mean, we're thinking, caring, feeling critters. And we like things the way we like them. And we're very smart and innovative. And when something isn't working, we make something that makes it work.
Yes.
And that's just the way humanity is.
Yes.
But you're right. We do not have control. And that illusion is, I think, what causes an awful lot of grief in this world.
I agree.
You know, the less control, mycelium's got more control than we do when it comes to their environment, you know?
And
they're very basic. Mycelium's a basic critter. It's got its job to do. It does it really well. It adapts when it needs to. It's not greedy. Some people would maybe say I'm wrong. There's a particular kind of mushroom, the honey mushroom, which is a fairly destructive mushroom. The biggest living organism in the world, they say, is this mycelial mat of honey mushroom that's up in eastern Oregon somewhere. I can never remember where. But its job is to take over. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, there's warring mycelium just like there's peace-loving mycelium.
And that's too bad.
There's maybe, you know, spiritual mycelium. And maybe
God only knows.
In the weeds we go.
So let's go, let's change tact a little bit.
Sure.
Because you also worked with Wild Rivers Connect and networking luncheons. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know a little bit about that too.
Sure. In fact, we just did a gathering yesterday up in Gold Beach, only 25 miles away.
Wait a minute.
So Wild Rivers Connect is another kind. It's a simple, similar to mycelium, I guess. Our focus is on connecting nonprofits to each other and to resources and to the communities at large. It started back in 2011 or 12, and Michelle Carrillo and Rachel Gates were the two who started it.
Mm-hmm.
It was Michelle's baby for the longest time. And then as it grew, they decided that rather than just had a database to start with, and they decided a website was probably going to be more useful for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so by then, Michelle had moved on to working for Building Healthy Communities down in Del Norte County, part of Wild Rivers Community Foundation. And so they hired a young man, Stephen Williams, who was a computer geek, if you will, and he created the first website, Wild Rivers Connect. And the idea behind the website is to have a place for all nonprofits, whether you're an official 501c3 or not. If you're an entity that's working for the good of your community, Wild Rivers Connect is the place for you. And we were trying to connect the communities in Del Norte with the communities in Curry and the communities within each county with each other and the nonprofits with each other. And the goal was to also let the community know that there was a central place where you could come and find out about who's out there, what they're doing, what they need.
Excellent.
And that was what the website was for.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought me on 3 years ago, as the outreach coordinator through a grant funded by Ford Family Foundation and Wild Rivers Coast Alliance together. And my job was outreach, of course. So we had been doing luncheons periodically, almost monthly, but not consistent. And so I came on board, and one of my jobs was to make those luncheons a bit more consistent and to spread them out. So we started doing luncheons in Port Orford and Gold Beach. We networked with Crescent City as much as possible. They were doing their own luncheons down there by then, so we didn't go that direction, but we did invite them. And the idea was to bring these people together to network, to learn. We brought in grant funders a number of times to talk with people about what kind of funding is out there and how to go about getting it. And yesterday's gathering was, we had John Moriarty from Oregon Community Foundation down to talk about the new thing they're doing called office hours. So in November, specifically, I believe it's the 6th and the 7th, from 10 a.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m., you'll have to email me if you want more details, John will be in Gold Beach at the library, and you can call ahead of time and schedule 20-minute conversations with him. And you can go up and you can talk to him about, how do I apply for a grant through you?
Oh,
or
wow.
You can say, hey, I tried a grant with you once and it didn't get, mm-hmm. it didn't do well. What should I do differently mm-hmm. next time? Or you can just talk about, hey, we have a problem in town. You know, our housing is mm-hmm. an issue. What do you guys think we should maybe try to do to mm-hmm. make a difference? Or you can just go up and get to know them as a funder. He said, large nonprofits are really comfortable at talking to these funders mm-hmm. on a regular basis mm-hmm. about anything. Call them up and say, hey, you know, I just wanted to bounce this off of you or something.
Right.
But small nonprofits are intimidated.
Absolutely.
Especially by a foundation like Oregon Community Foundation,
right.
which is the largest foundation in the state.
Right.
So John came from the world of executive director of a watershed mm-hmm. for 11 years. That's what he did until he came on board with Oregon Community Foundation. So he knows what it's like to go after funding.
Right.
And he thought, let's just make this place where people can come in and get to know him and he can get to know you. And you don't have
idea.
To have a grant in mind.
Right.
Just call them up, make an appointment so that you don't have to go up there and spend 4 hours waiting for him,
right.
you know, to clear his calendar. Make an appointment and go on up and chat with him. And this is the first of them, November 6th and 7th. And
excellent
if it takes off,
idea.
I assume they'll do that maybe quarterly.
Wow.
And in fact, the next grant cycle for their, is it their small grants? Community grant, I think is what it's called. The cycles is, let's see, December, I think it opens December 1st and it ends January 15th, I believe.
Okay.
Are the dates.
Okay.
So that was yesterday.
Yeah.
So there were about 20 of us in the room and it was a 2-hour gathering. We gave people food. John talked first and then we told everybody about the newest feature on our soon to be unveiled upgraded website, Wild Rivers Connect. The website was getting clunky and it was starting to break down because we weren't updating it properly. And so we have now partnered with Community Websites. That's another Ford Family Foundation project.
Great.
And we're moving our Wild Rivers Connect site onto their system. Funny thing is, Stephen Williams, who created our website, he then went on to the Community Websites project, and he's now building websites for communities all over the state based on ours.
Great.
So,
great.
We're the pioneers again.
So isn't it funny
it
how
is,
things
yeah.
are just tied together?
It's mycelium.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So the newest feature of the website, once it's up and running, is a volunteer portal, where nonprofits such as KCIW can post the kinds of volunteer needs you have. We hope to make it really specific
brilliant.
With categories. Everyone's been asking us for that for years. That's the one thing people said,
wow.
please do this, please
yeah.
do this. So community websites, that was one of the things they took to this new project, was that particular feature. And then you guys can post stuff, and then people who are looking for ways to volunteer can come and find out what there is. You
brilliant.
Can help each other out, say, the Monarch Festival needs canopies. They could put that, like happened this year.
Yes.
They could put that on this page
right.
and say, hey, to all you nonprofits out there, we need some canopies. And then
right.
other nonprofits could respond and say, hey, we'll loan you ours,
right.
et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah.
So, Kathleen, tell me about this year's Mushroom Festival. Where's it going to be? What are the times, you know, dates, all that?
Sure. So, the third annual Wild Rivers Mushroom Festival is going to be at the Checo Activity Center again. That's where it was last year. First weekend of November, which this year is November 2nd and 3rd. That's Saturday and Sunday.
So is it always the first weekend
always
in November?
Always the first weekend in November.
Good.
It's going to be interesting when we get to the place where the 1st of November is a Sunday. Because then we will probably put it the next weekend, which
yeah.
is going to feel like the second weekend, but really is the first weekend.
Right. Well, we'll worry about that when the...
Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, 10 to 4 both days. The festival itself is free. And what I mean by that is if all you want to do is come and see the big display of mushrooms on that giant table, maybe talk to somebody about what's there, buy some things from the vendors, maybe eat some mushroom food, drink some mushroom beer, hang out with mushroom people, that's free. That part is free. Downstairs is where we have all of the educational workshops and presentations. Those will all cost something. It ranges from, I believe, $750 is the the basic presentation cost on up to a couple of hands-on workshops that we have this year. One is on how to grow mushrooms, and one is on using mushrooms to dye fabric, both of which will include some hands-on take-home stuff. Those workshops run more like $20 or $30, but that includes the part like the log that you take home that's already inoculated with shiitake, for instance.
Fascinating.
So those things all cost. And then we're also scheduling, I believe it's 8 or 9 different mushroom hikes, identification hikes. We're not doing any picking, folks. Remember that. We're taking you out there. We're going to point out all the mushrooms. We're going to show you what's there and what's not. But we aren't going to be doing any harvesting. You do that on your own. And the ID hikes will run generally $5 a piece. They're limited in scope. We can only take 10, 15 people on a hike. And so those tickets are only available at the festival on Saturday and Sunday, November 2nd and 3rd. The tickets for the workshops are available now through the website.
Okay.
And that is www.wildriversmushroomfestival.com. Go there, and there's a page that says Workshops and Speakers, and on that page is a Buy Tickets Now, and if you click there, you go to Eventbrite, which is where our tickets are sold through, and you can buy all your tickets there.
God, that just sounds like an amazing festival.
We are trying to create a premier Oregon Coast festival along the lines of Yahats, which is north of us, the last weekend in October, I believe. Telluride is another biggie in Colorado. That is probably one of the best in the country or the world even. And that happens in August. We're trying to create.
Because it's colder there? Is that?
Different kind of mushrooms, okay. Different season in Colorado. And of course, I know because I lived there, the rainy season, if you will, is usually summertime. And oftentimes in Colorado, the clouds, they bump up against the Rockies, they build up, and every afternoon it rains for about 30 minutes. Mm. And you can almost set your clock by it.
Wow.
And it just dumps on you for a short while, and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. So mushrooms love moisture. And in Colorado, mushrooms then grow best during the summer when it's raining. In the winter, yes, it freezes, and most mushrooms don't grow in the snow.
Right.
Springtime, the weather's too iffy. Fall, it tends to get a bit dry. Mm-hmm. So that's their season. So we're after, say in 5 years or 10 years, we're trying to be along the same, at the same level as Telluride and Yahats and a couple of the other big ones that, there's a great Morel Mushroom Festival in Michigan every year, for instance, in May.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to place ourselves amongst the best. And so we're always looking for speakers that are quality speakers. We're bringing one of the authors of the book, Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast. His name is Noah Siegel. He will be our keynote this year. So he's speaking on Saturday from 2 to 4. Tickets are on sale at the website. If we don't sell out, we will have tickets available at the festival. But please don't count on that. If you really want to hear Noah, you probably ought to go on the website now and buy a ticket. We've also got returning from last year. We had a really popular speaker, Misha with Myrtle Glen Farm. She's also a Wild Rivers Coast Food Trail member.
Oh.
And she and her husband are doing an experience during Live Culture Coast, which is the last 2 weeks of October. Yeah. another new event. Anyway, Misha is coming to do her permaculture talk. Anna Moore is a returning speaker. She's a specialist on mushrooms of the dunes. She will be doing her presentation, and she's leading 2 mushroom identification hikes at the Talua Dunes on Sunday.
Kidding. Mushrooms of the Dunes. I never heard of it.
Yeah.
They're really mushrooms at the dunes?
Oh, porcini. Oh, my goodness. The porcini this year is everywhere. And now you're not allowed to pick mushrooms in the Talua Dunes Park.
Right.
But down there, there's lots of dune area that's not part of the Talua Dunes. And the porcini this year are just going gangbusters.
Amazing.
They're everywhere.
Amazing.
They're absolutely everywhere.
Amazing.
Yeah, so, you know, a variety of stuff. We've even got, this is cool, so we put our website out there, and I, you know, I'm doing part of the promotion, so I'm shooting it out on Facebook all over the place. And I send a copy to the Colorado Mycological Society, because I'm on their Facebook group page. I get an email from a gentleman, John Summer, who says, hey, I want to come to the festival, I'm going to fly out there, and I would like to help.
Oh.
And I'm like, what would you like to do? He says, well, I would love to do a workshop. I could even lead a hike or two. And I'm like, cool. So he's doing our introduction to mushrooms Saturday morning at 10. And then he'll be leading a mushroom hike, I believe, It might be Saturday afternoon, if not, it's Sunday. Mm-hmm. And it's just stuff like that happens. So, you know, we're trying to make this a really valuable, creative, fun event. It's all about the mushroom, though. It's we don't have music going. There's mm-hmm. not a whole bunch of partying at night. It's mm-hmm. all about the mushrooms. But if you want to know what there is in our woods and what wonderful things mushrooms do and how cool the world mm-hmm. of mycelium is, you got to come to the festival.
I remember going out with your group.
I remember.
I had a camera at the time.
Yes, you were the TV person.
Yes, I was shooting
it. Maybe that's how we met. That's
it might have been, yeah.
And you interviewed me.
And what I remember most about that is that everybody would kind of go off on their own, mm-hmm. you know, ones and maybe twos mm-hmm. occasionally. But you're in the middle of the wilderness. Uh-huh. And if you're not familiar with the wilderness, mm. it is really easy to get turned around,
yes.
really easy to get lost.
Yes.
And I remember whoever I was with, he was looking for mushrooms and I was filming it, and we wandered off. Well, pretty soon I couldn't hear anybody else. I had no idea where we were, where the car was. I mean, it was like, wow. Uh-huh. So I would think that would be one of the challenges when you're out there. You don't want to get lost.
You're right. In every mushroom season, somebody gets lost up in the woods. Most of the time they get found. We have a fabulous search and rescue team here. Occasionally someone doesn't get found. And I do recall a few instances where folks have died in the woods getting lost picking mushrooms. So the trick is, you go with someone else, you stay close to the road to begin with. We used to use radios or whistles, or one of the things we would do a lot, and you probably remember this, we would yo about every 15 minutes. And I was anal about it. I mean, when I took a group out to learn mushrooms for the first time, I was every 5 minutes, yo. And mm-hmm. I told them at the start, I'm like, when you hear me yo, you better answer. If you don't answer, mm-hmm. I'm going to come looking for mm-hmm. you because I'm going to think you're lost in some gully
That's
somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, you have to be really, really cognizant of where you are. And yes, those woods are dense and you get turned around. You'll be climbing up a hill and you'll go this ways and you'll mm-hmm. come down on the other side mm-hmm. and you won't know you're on the other side.
That's right.
That happened to us once.
Yeah.
And luckily we hit a road that came out to the road we needed to be on. But, you know, it is easy to get lost. So you're very cognizant of your space and you go with people and you're constantly communicating
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. that's the best way to stay safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it really is a remarkable thing when you're out mm-hmm. there. You do get really involved.
Head down.
And your head is down, that's right, and you're looking for the mushrooms and you're finding them
uh-huh.
or you think you're almost finding
uh-huh.
them, so you keep scrambling, you know. And it's so easy to lose track of time, to lose
yeah.
track of where you are. I mean, it's just...
One of the first things that we do when the Mushroom Club starts meeting again, which is September through April, we do a safety talk, and usually Terry Alloway gives it. And part of it is that. It's also about, you know, during hunting season, wearing orange, being cognizant of mm-hmm. that as well.
Absolutely.
Always telling someone where you're going, mm-hmm. You know, making sure that they know what time you expect to be home, how to pick mushrooms properly in case you're not sure what they are, how to mm-hmm. separate them from each other in case one's maybe a poisonous one and one's not,
mm-hmm.
how not to eat something just, you know, based on what your brother Joe's boss Bob told you, you know, that kind of stuff.
But my boss said it was okay.
Yeah, you know, all of those things.
Yeah.
But not to detract from the amazing world of mycelium. There's so much about it that just fascinates me and people like me. And so those parts, the parts that can mm-hmm. be dangerous, mm-hmm. we learn in the beginning
yep.
so that we don't end up, you know, in trouble, so that we
yep.
can continue to learn and love this world that we
Because the wilderness is an amazing and magical
oh,
place.
Oh, yeah.
It really...
You get out there and there's no one around
exactly.
and the birds and the squirrels
exactly.
and the chipmunks and the deer and the mushrooms.
You don't actually want to come back anyway.
No.
Yeah.
In the beginning, we would stay out there for 3-4 nights at a time.
Oh, yeah.
And just pick mushrooms.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can.
Back when I didn't have a job.
I can so... absolutely relate to it because it's amazing. It's just an amazing, amazing place, amazing thing to do. It's just, so I'm really looking forward to this Mushroom Festival. It's grown enormously over the 3 years. This is, you know.
We have, I want to make sure I mention this, we have a children's workshop for the first time. It's free.
Wonderful.
And a gentleman that's a teacher in Crescent City, his name is Ku Vu. He'll be teaching it. He was a commercial mushroom picker back, I think, when I was, and I think we know each other. Mm-hmm. He used to do some commercial picking when he was working on his degree.
Excellent.
And so he's going to do a kids' workshop. So we're always trying to add more stuff that the community can come and learn from us. And, you know, it's just, it's amazing how much is out there in our own backyards. And open your eyes and take a look around. And
I mean, seriously, anybody who says that there's nothing to do
here. Oh, Lord. I roll my eyes every time I hear that. Excuse me?
I know. So give some contact information so people can get in touch with you if they've got questions or they can go to your website or whatever so they can.
Okay. I'm going to spit out a lot of websites because we talked about a lot of stuff.
Right ahead, honey.
So first of all is the festival, the Wild Rivers Mushroom Festival.com. That's the festival. Our email is wildriversmushroomclub@gmail.com. And also, my number is 541-661-1385. You can call that number for any of the things I talked about. The food trail is wrcfoodtrail.com. The Wild Rivers Connect is wildriversconnect@gmail.com. Otterbees is otterbeesmarket.com.
I love it. Keep going, baby. We can just whip this telephone book together here.
I think that's it. And my email, if you need to email me, let me see, which one should I use? Let's use this one. The letter K, Dickson, Dickson@1961.gmail.com. You can catch me on that one for anything I talked about.
And quite frankly, you talked about a lot of stuff. I mean, I knew that you had your finger in a lot of pies, but I wasn't quite sure how many, and I'm impressed.
You know, when we first moved here, we learned right away that the way to stay here and enjoy living here is to get creative and diversify.
Yep.
And so I have had generally at least two or three jobs at all times ever since I moved here 17 years ago.
Good for you.
I've always been my own boss.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Mm-hmm. But I chose that way so that I could stay and enjoy the ocean and the mountain and the rivers and everything about this place.
Because it's an amazing place. It really is.
That's all it takes. Just work hard and live long and prosper.
I love that. Kathleen, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all that.
You are welcome.
It's been a delightful chat. We finally got to sit down and catch up. It's absolutely wonderful.
Yes, very cool. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for listening. You've been listening to Our Community on KCIW. My guest today was Kathleen Dickson, the creator, although she doesn't own that. She thinks it's the entire club, of the annual Mushroom Festival here in Brookings. If you'd like to hear it again, check out our weekly schedule on our website, kciw.org, or listen to the podcast listed under our community programs. While you're there, consider donating to help us continue to provide quality local programming. Or come join us. We're all volunteers and are always looking for people who'd like to get involved, either in front of the mic or behind the scenes. And we're happy to teach you what we know. This is Candace Michelle. Thank you.